Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with Matt Grossman, who is the author of Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. Matt, how are you doing?
Doing quite well.
You were here with us about 2 years ago and are back very soon. Not only am I impressed by your book, but I'm impressed by how quickly you were able to write it. So before we get to it, maybe you can just remind everyone who you are, where you are, and what you do.
My name is Matt Grossman, and I'm a newly reappointed now associate professor of political science.
Congratulations.
July, at Michigan State University, and I also direct something called the Michigan Policy Network for students to write about state policy issues. And my first book was on interest groups called the Not-So-Special Interests, and I was interviewed here about that. And this one is on American policymaking since 1945.
Yeah, it's... One thing that I do know from reading your previous book and some other stuff that you've written is that you're not reticent to take on convention. And you take on some of the big ones here, some of the big conventions in this field of studying how the public policy process works. So to start us off, I wonder if you'd explain a little bit about some of the big theories that you challenge in the book.
Well, I really try to take a very holistic look at what causes policy change and what are the major trends in American policymaking and how can we account for them. And one of the perspective that I ended up with after reading hundreds of policy histories is that some of the things that we think we know about policymaking don't seem to be all that consistent with the historical evidence. So the first is that most of the research on the policy process tends to take the agenda, especially the agenda from the public or the media, as having sort of the first step in the policy process and being quite important, deciding what issues to discuss. So that's the first one I take on. How important is it that an issue be at the center of the agenda, or that we've decided that we need to address a problem in order to get policy change? And then the second is the sort of macro politics literature that says that we can know the direction and amount of policymaking that we're going to get via trends in partisanship, ideology, and election results. And I challenge that quite a bit as well. And then the final big set of theories that I challenge is that we can sort of divide the policy spectrum into a few major types of policymaking, and that the politics will correspond to what kind of policy type we're looking at. And I find that the patterns just aren't quite that neat.
Yeah, you write at the start of the book, sort of to this point, and I quote, "The analysis pursued here focuses between the macro-level patterns sought by political scientists and the micro-level explanations of policy historians." What exists in this middle region? What's the nuts and bolts of this area in between these two bigger, or not bigger, these two other traditions out there in the field?
Well, I think so. I guess to define the macro as sort of big trends in parties, election results, ideology, public opinion, and defining the micro as, you know, these individuals were working on this particular proposal and they held this hearing and they endorsed this language and they got it through Congress. And I'm trying to draw from the micro level accounts to say how consistent are they with the macro level, and then can we build something in the middle? And I think what comes out is that the middle is networks of important actors in American politics from the legislative and executive branch, but also from the interest group community, who establish themselves as major players in the policymaking process and then may or may not develop the kinds of relationships and ideas that allow policymaking to move forward.
One of the really interesting parts of the book, and one of the real novel parts of the book, is the data that you put together, and these are different data than we've come to expect, and so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you put these data together, who helped you, and what they permit you to do that other data sources could not.
Well, most of the data comes from policy histories, which are usually book-length accounts of policymaking in a particular issue area. So you have a book like Environmental Policymaking, 1960 to 1980. And the idea was that these kinds of accounts give play-by-play accounts of what happened. They also try to account for why we got some outcome rather than another outcome. And my idea was to compile all of these. So there are several hundred accounts that we then systematically coded with a bunch of research assistants here at Michigan State, and to try to come up with, number one, just a timeline, what actions occurred. So there were 790 what I call significant policy changes since 1945, and those were mostly laws passed by Congress, but they also included some executive orders, some agency rules, and some judicial decisions that were considered policy changes by these policy historians. And then I went about tracking the accounts that these historians gave for each policy change to try to figure out what the most commonly cited factors were and which were not cited quite as often, and also to look at the particular individuals and organizations that were credited with policy change. So with that second part, I can also create networks of actors that were responsible for the same policy changes to get sort of a global look at who was involved at what time. And then I try to take the new data that I have and map on any previous data that we've been using onto that new set. So the easiest thing is that we have lots of data on a general pattern since 1945 in election results, public opinion, and parties. So I try to use that to predict policy outcomes, and you know, whatever I can map on to either overtime change or cross issue change from other people's data sources, I try to do that as well.
How long did this take? What's the time span of the? Because this is sounds like it must have taken a lot of research assistance, a lot of reading, a lot of coding. What's the time span that a project like this takes you?
I started on it almost as soon as I came to Michigan State, so that's about 7 years. But you know, it wasn't my main project during the first 4 years of that. So depending on your perspective, it either took 7 years or it took my main project of about 2 years.
However long it took, it really did produce something very interesting, allowed you to do some very interesting empirical analysis. One thing that you found, and we're not going to be able to talk about everything that you found, but one of the things that you found is that public opinion and media coverage, two big parts of the story that we typically understand about the policy process, really don't matter that much, particularly in isolation. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why this is the case. Have I characterized the finding in the right way? And if they don't matter that much, then what did?
Well, I think there are several indications that public opinion and media coverage don't have that much impact on the policy process, at least it's not as much as we've hoped or that we have come to believe. First is that trends in what issues are important to the public or what issues are being addressed by the media don't comport well with where we actually see policy change. So if something reaches the top of the public in the media agenda, like gun control, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get it. And you can get policy changes like student loan reform, even if it isn't near the top of the agenda at the time. And then the second piece of evidence is that trends in the liberal or conservative nature of public opinion don't seem to comport well with liberal or conservative trends in policymaking in general. And then the third is just that policy historians don't usually have explanations that involve public opinion or media coverage. They occasionally do, but when public opinion and media coverage are involved, it tends to be alongside your inside factors like presidential leadership, things happening in Congress, and interest group advocacy. So the the main reason I think that you have those three findings on the lack of influence of public opinion is just that so much of the policy process is an internal story. It's about what's happening in Washington between legislators, administrators, and interest groups, and they have at least, you know, some connection to the public and some reason to be responsive in some cases, but the connections aren't quite as much as our theory might lead us to believe. They're pretty insular, and they can make policy without much attention or intervention by the public.
Now, you talk to people about these findings, and they're a little counterintuitive, both to people who study public opinion, but also to the general public. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the reactions and how you explain these kinds of findings to maybe people who are deeply engaged in outside strategies that focus on trying to change public opinion or try to shape media coverage. What have you had any conversations like that, and how do you try to explain these kinds of empirical findings to those that you know, maybe are up close and point to anecdotes where media coverage does matter? What's that conversation like?
I would say I haven't had as much pushback from sort of advocates or members of the public as I might have expected, because I think it is now sort of conventional wisdom in the public that Washington policymaking is insular and can kind of go forward without much input from the public. And if you talk, I mean, it depends what kinds of advocates, but if you talk to interest group leaders, most of them know that external mobilization is a tactic and important part of some storyline. But I certainly would not be surprised that internal negotiations in Congress with the administration and among interest groups are more important. I think I have had more pushback from people who study the relationship between public opinion and policy for a living. And in part, it's about sort of the specific historical contingencies. So one of the big findings in the book is that from 1961 to 1976, we had a whole lot of policymaking across all branches of government, and it was very liberal in content. It expanded the scope of government dramatically. Now, that is wouldn't be surprising to anyone who studies policymaking, although the extension to the mid-70s might be a little bit more surprising. But I think people have all sorts of explanations for why that era was different than the others, and they tend to grasp on one or to say that it was a very different form of era. So that, I think, is the main point where I've found a pushback, because the approach that I take in the book is just to say this era was very different. It was multifaceted. There were lots of reasons for it. But we can't just say it was different because of public opinion, or it was different because Democrats controlled the legislature by overwhelming margins, because some of those things were true in other eras, didn't lead to the same things, it was also a period of part of it was a period of divided government, so didn't quite match the expectations that people have about what might create the liberal epoch.
Yeah, in chapter 5, you do some different things, you reach some different conclusions about different policy areas. You write that the advocacy coalition framework would be most useful for the areas of agriculture and housing policy, path dependency for education, and punctuated equilibrium for nuclear energy and budgets. I wonder what these conclusions say about more general theories of the policy process, each one of them having maybe a slightly different approach that works. What about the general theory that we can take away from the conclusions of your book and these specific findings about each policy area?
Well, if we want to take an inductive approach and try to build general theory from national American policymaking from the last seven decades, then there isn't going to be a whole lot that we can say applies to all or even most cases. I would say that the main things we can say is that the executive branch and the legislative branch are usually jointly involved in policymaking, and that interest groups have a fairly large role in in most policy processes. We can also say, I think, that the interactions among those actors are quite important, and that the that their long-term relationships and experiences together make a difference in the amount of policy that you're going to see, and the liberal or conservative trends in policy output. So that's sort of the starting point, I think, should be the starting point for any new theories of policy making. And that doesn't, you know, leave a whole lot of general ground for building a theory that explains when we're going to get one type of policy rather than another. In that chapter, what I tried to say is, well, it looks like some issue areas are a little bit more similar to the kinds of things that you would expect from some theories of policy making than others. And it could be that a part of our problem in the past has been that we've selected some policies, created a theory that explains those policies and expected the theory to travel. And people have been doing that in different policy areas with different theories. It could be that the theories don't travel very well, that they really only explain policymaking in that area or in a few areas.
You know, one of the other takeaways, it seems, and you write this right at the end of the book, is, as you say, the best bet in Washington politics is always on the status quo. Quote, not much is the best answer for what might happen over the next decade. Does this kind of conclusion lead you to be a pessimist about the capacity of the process to solve major problems or even unforeseen problems in the future? Or is this kind of gradualism something that you take heart from?
I think it's certainly true that the status quo has a major advantage in politics, but it is also true that to the extent that we change policy, we do tend to grow the responsibilities of government over time. So the norm is to get some expansions of government responsibility in a few areas at a time, and then only sporadically and concentrated in the 1960s and 1970s did we see a cross-issue, cross-branch expansion of government responsibility. I would say that it is mostly dismaying that we don't seem to have a very coherent process for identifying problems that we want to solve and evaluating alternatives and selecting one. But I do see some advantages to long processes of consideration and policy development and to coalition building across interests and across parties. Having a big role in the policy process. So it's dismaying that it's hard to change policy and that the public doesn't seem to have a very big role in it, but it is somewhat more comforting that in order to actually get the policy changes that we do have, it tends to take a longer period with experienced individuals and groups involved in negotiations.
Yeah, this book is really interesting, and as I mentioned at the start, this is the second in just a couple of years. What's next for you? Are you working on something new, either with the similar data or similar methods, or what's on your desk?
My next big project is on differences between the American left and the American right. So we are with this co-authored project with Dave Hopkins at Boston College, and we are our main theory is that the Democrats are best conceived as a coalition of interest groups, whereas the Republicans are best conceived as an ideological coalition. And so we look at the differences between the social group basis of the Democrats and the ideological basis of the Republicans to try to explain things like why do we have a Tea Party on the right and no real equivalent on the left? Why does Republican governance look quite different than Democratic governance? And also to say a little bit about why we might have stasis or stagnation. The big point being that the American public remains relatively conservative in a general sense, but quite liberal in specific policy areas. And so we have this a general conservatism and specific liberalism that allows both parties to draw from public opinion to maintain some support.
Well, I hope when that project finishes and you and your co-author will come back and you can join the three-timer club. Until that point, you're in the two-timer club with just a select few of others. Matt's book, again, is Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945, published by Oxford University Press. I hope that everybody goes out and has a chance to read this. I think you'd really enjoy it. Matt, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.